Testing 1, 2, 3. Hopefully everything is set up well here. Now I have to switch gears and I have everyone sitting down. Is it working back in the back there, the sound? No, I mean farther back in the room back there. Adrian's checking it out. Way back in the mother's room. It's working? It says it's on. There's a little green light that's on. I don't know if it's working or not. That's okay. Okay. Now that you're all seated, if you'd rise, I'd like to ask Mr. Rex Blake to come forward for the opening prayer.
Eternal Father in heaven, we just thank you so very much for the privilege to be able to come before you on this, the first day of your Feast of Tabernacles, the Holy Day. We thank you for bringing visitors from overseas and watching over them, and just appreciate all that you do for us in every way. Just ask for your presence with us through this service this morning, that you'll inspire the speaking, you'll inspire our hearing, and let's be able to take in the message that you have for us. And we give you thanks for all things, pray for your constant presence with us, now and always. Do this all in the name of your Son, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen. Amen.
Okay, looks like the recording's working well here, so that's a major thing. I have two computers going. Hopefully that if one of them crashes, the other will be okay, because stranger things have happened. Anyway. Well, now we're going to try something we haven't done in a long, long time. It's been several years. So hopefully everyone has their first song there, "O Come and Let Us Worship Him." So at all the different feast sites here, everyone will be singing along here. And we're going to make a joyous noise, no matter what we sound like. So I'm going to try this with the music in the background here, and hopefully this is going to work. So if you'd all rise, we're going to have to begin as soon as this starts, so I'll lead you in it. So let me do this. This is a new experience here. Okay, I think we're ready now, so at least we have the correct song, and we'll try this. Come, let us in songs to God our cheerful voices raise. In joyful shouts let us the rock of our salvation praise. Before His presence let us come with praise and thankful voice. Let us sing psalms to Him with grace and make a joyful noise. For God, a mighty God and King, above all gods He is. The depths of earth are in His hand, the strength of hills is His. To Him the spacious sea belongs, for He the same did make. The dry land also from His hands its form at first did take. O come and let us worship Him, let us bow down with awe, and on our knees before the Lord, our Maker, let us fall. Because He only is our God, and we His people are. And of His pasture we are sheep, in His almighty care. They held it out longer than we did, but very good. That's it. You'll all be seated. Well, I'm going to pull a plug on that one. I'm not, I didn't hit the right exit, I guess, when I quit there. There we go. Hopefully by the end of the feast, we'll have this down to a fine art. I could, but see, even then, it's still been the wrong song. Well, Well, it's good to be back in New Zealand again, and the weather hasn't been really good, but it's great to be back in New Zealand. A little chilly. We have one from Hawaii with us here at the feast site, and he's been wearing gloves, and quite an experience for him, changing weather. Someone said they saw snow, I guess a couple of you did, or maybe three of you did, saw some snow on the way here, drive up here from farther south, coming up this way, and I hope it stays south of here. So, anyway, it's really great to be able to meet new people again. Met several new people here, some last night, and again this morning here, so even had a baptism yesterday, so that was great to be able to meet a new individual just baptized yesterday. And he's all the way from the South Island on the farthest tip. I think it's part of the city south, isn't it? So, Invercargill, is that right? Yeah. And then we have some from the Gisborne area here that are new. Did I say that right as well? Okay. Very good. Okay. Well, this is a different kind of feast. I've really been excited for a long time to give these sermons, to get into the subject matter of these sermons. And you won't hear a new truth today, but you'll know the direction it's going. But we're going to get into those as we go along. And also on the system as we go along, once I have covered a couple of the two truths that we're going to be discussing here out of the four, we're going to put it on the website because everything has been written up and so forth. And they've been written a little differently as well. So I thought I'd just let everyone know that. They're not written exactly the same as what the sermons will be. There's a little difference in there to help you to digest better what is going to be given here throughout the feast. And that should prove to be exciting to everyone. So, again, welcome to everyone in all the feast sites around the world, wherever you are, over there in Europe and also in the U.S. and Canada. It's really good to be able to have so many different ones being able to come together this year like this. So, thought I might as well pass on another little story to you before I begin here to kind of go along with the difference of the kind of feast we're having this year because of the messages we're going to have. We've known for a long time that things have been really stirred up out there in the spirit world, if you will, because of some of the stuff that's going to be covered here during the feast. And I think it's been a lot harder for most people, or a lot of people anyway, this year, different ones I've talked to before the Feast of Tabernacles this year than obviously most feasts. You can generally expect some things to be stirred up around the Passover period, before the Passover period. That's pretty common. Spirit world, Satan, demons, they get stirred up a lot during that time of year. They try to make it more difficult for God's people. They try to make it difficult in the sense of getting you sidetracked, getting you focused on other things rather than the excitement of God's plan for Passover and the days of unleavened bread. So that's kind of a common thing. And have any of you ever had those experiences? Yes? Yeah? I see. Okay. So that is common. And also before the Feast of Tabernacles is another period of time because they don't want you to rejoice. God says to rejoice at His feast. And they don't want you to rejoice. They want you to get sidetracked. They want you to be focused on other things. They don't want you to receive the fullness of what God is giving you year by year by year. And so this year has been very much that way. And I think one of the strongest in the sense of difficulties and troubles and trials and hardships that have been going on as people have been preparing for this Feast of Tabernacles. Anyway, I thought I'd mention along those lines something rather unique that happened yesterday. We were in Auckland getting ready to fly over here to Rotorua. Most of you here in this area know it because I told you about this last night, but I'm telling everyone else now out there that some of the group that was with us, we had 9 altogether coming over. And anyway, looking across the airport, there was Joe Jr. And most of you know who he is. His father is the one that I've made comment about. Very strong comments about being the man of sin, the son of perdition, and the end time here. And evidently was coming to the same area here. He's in Rotorua as well, same time we are here now. And he happened to be on the same flight, as a matter of fact. But before we got on the flight, they actually called for 2 people to come forward to the Air New Zealand desk because the plane was overloaded and they wanted to be able to take some luggage off. So they called up Joe Jr. They didn't call Joe Jr., they said Joe Takach or Takach. And they called me up as well. So we both went up there, and I was standing kind of beside him there, back of him there. Someone else is up front. And then they asked for both people to come forward. Now, how strange is that? I mean, really, what are the odds of being able to be here in this part of the world and the very individual that is very much responsible for the apostasy, because he was right behind his father in the apostasy, should be in the same part of the world at this time in this particular season here. And then both of us to be called up to the front desk there like that to be taking some of the luggage off. Anyway, to make a long story short, they ask, we need to take somebody's luggage off. Would that be okay with you? And so I asked, I said, well, what time will the next flight be? And they said 4:30. And I said, well, just take ours off. And he looked at the woman, he looked back at me, and he says, he's really a nice guy, isn't he? speaking of me. Okay, anyway. Just kidding. Anyway, we were walking away then from there, and he says, that's really nice of you. He said it again, you're really a nice guy. And I said, yeah. I said, you don't recognize me, do you? And he said, no, should I? And he didn't recognize the name when it was up there, the way they pronounce names, a little bit different to accent here than what we do in the States. And anyway, I said, I don't remember this word for word, but I might have said Ron Wineland. And anyway, his response was, from Ohio? Something of that nature anyway. And I said, yes. So we talked a little bit then, not too much. We talked a little bit about some general things. And anyway, a little bit later he came by and was talking again. He went to get a coffee and stopped by and discussed some things again. He talked about some of the different church groups that splintered and the like. And to me, just an overview, just to let you know, it was kind of a sickening thing because it brings up all the past, all the suffering people went through. And he was making some comment about United and Living and Philadelphia and some of the others. And I told him, I said, it's really been hard on people over the years. I said, there's so many groups out here splintered off, and it's really been hard on people. And he kind of acknowledged that. And that was just my sentiment, thinking how hard it's been on people because of what we suffered through, what the church has suffered through, and really what they've caused. And he doesn't even understand what he's caused. But anyway, sad times we live in. You think about different ones and what they've gone through because of a being, the very one this sermon is talking about today, Satan. Because of that being and all the troubles he's caused through the centuries, over the millennium to mankind, striving to thwart God's plan. And God allowed him to do some powerful things at the end time for a great purpose. We've lived through that. Many of us have anyway. Many of us in this room have. And we saw what happened to the church. Many of you are new. But a lot of us lived through that period of time. And it was very devastating, very difficult. It's been very difficult for God's people. So many today who aren't, in that respect, God's people in the sense of having contact or access to God's throne. They're cut off. They're asleep. And only a few have been blessed to be able to be reawakened, or awakened, I should say, and given the opportunity that we're now given. So, as the sermon here today, over the past couple of years, God has been blessing us with a more balanced vision of what He is going to bring to this earth, this picture in these feast days. We're almost there. It's incredible. The millennium is almost here. That's astounding. I think back many years ago, hearing Mr. Armstrong's voice as he'd speak at the Feast of Tabernacles and discuss this time of year and what we were picturing, and the church always planning ahead, 5 to 10 years, 10 years in advance, not knowing when things would happen, but knowing that we're getting close to the end time, knowing that we were living in the end time. So God gave to him an understanding that we were toward the very end of time. Philadelphia was one of the last eras to come along. He knew that there was another one coming, or a mixture of the two. Didn't fully understand those things at that point in time because God hadn't given it. But knowing that we were very, very close to the end. Saw Europe beginning to come together. Plain Truth magazine, editors, people were there in Europe when the common market was being formed there in Europe. Back in around 1950 or whenever it was when they were having some of their first meetings. And these things were being reported in Plain Truth magazine because God had given Mr. Armstrong an understanding that we were in the end times. And that Europe was going to arise again. There was going to be another rising of the Holy Roman Empire. One more time, the seventh time. And he knew those things. God had given that to him, prophecies about the United States and in Europe, and that there would be 10 nations that would arise. So again, how long? It hasn't been that long in the sense of mankind, but it's an awesome thing to think back and realize that we are almost there now to what they desired to see, what so many during that period of time in Philadelphia really desired to see.
People had a great desire to see things through to the end time. And we're the ones blessed to live through this period of time, to be witness of it all. It's an awesome thing. So we'd been doubtful whether or not we would even be able to be together this year. And it's an awesome thing that we're able to be together in many different locations for the full period of the feast this year. People have been around long enough now, and things have worked out to where we could people could save and prepare for the feast this year in a very special way. So we're very blessed to be able to do this. And what an incredible thing. If, because I don't know, God hasn't given it to me. If we're able to be together one more time. I just want you to know it is possible. Prophetically, it is possible. Okay, whether it'll happen or not, we don't know. Actually, I was thinking this morning, we're going to plan for it. You always have to plan ahead. We're going to plan for it like it's going to happen. And if a month from now, or a week from now, or you know, several months down the road here from now, we realize it's going to be impossible, then so be it. You know, God will help us to adjust according to whatever happens at any particular time, but we're going to plan ahead. So it's an awesome thing to understand what we've been blessed to have and to realize how close we are. To understand that we're living in a period of time. At one time we thought we would be in great devastation at the very beginning of a period called, you know, of 3.5 years before the return of Christ. And yet, here we are. Very blessed indeed, that we're not suffering. God has blessed us mightily. So with the more balanced vision that God has been giving us over the past several years, which He has been blessing us mightily, because His kingdom is coming, because His Son is about to come to this earth, because His government is about ready to be established, God has been blessing us with greater soundness of mind, greater balance of His plan and purpose for us, of those things that are going to come to take place. And today's focus in this particular sermon, this is going to be a two-part sermon, concerns some of the greatest good news in the gospel message that God is giving to mankind. Satan's rule is nearly over. And the rule of the kingdom of God, with Jesus Christ as King of Kings, is almost here. And this transition is most profound in all of human history. It truly is. It's so awesome and so incredible what we're blessed to witness. The title of this sermon was going to be Satan's End. But the beginning of the millennium is not about his end, but his nearly 1,000 years of confinement. So the sermon was entitled Satan's Confinement. And then I changed it again as God was leading me through this. And it came to be Satan's Confinement and His End, Part 1. And so God revealed what it should be and where the sermon was to go. So today we're going to start out in a story flow here. If you want to begin turning over to the book of Job. We're going to look at this being and some of the things he's done through time. It's really difficult to convey the power of such good news that God has given, because it is a part of the gospel message. It is a part of the good news of God's kingdom coming to this earth. That Satan's not going to be around during the millennium. That's great news. And then the 100 years beyond, you know, he's only going to be let out for a little time. And then Satan not being in the presence of mankind again. Incredible thing. So again, very awesomely good news. It truly is. That's why I couldn't help but think, especially concerning this series here, as Mr. Matthews was going through and talking about atonement and thinking about what that day means. Even though we were fasting, to me, it's a time of rejoicing. It truly is, to understand what is going to take place with this being, his separation, and the things that must come to pass. So, let's begin by going through this particular story here, because we are coming up to a time when there's going to be a great transition in government. God bless Mr. Armstrong to see in a very powerful way, so many of his sermons, especially around the Feast of Tabernacles, had to do with government, because it boils down to God's government, which is God's way. There is only one way of life, which is a matter of how life is governed. And whether or not we choose to be governed by that way, whether we want it to regulate our lives. And that's a choice we have to make. And it is government. But man is kind of adverse to the word government. But the reality is, we must have government. Human beings have to have government. We have to be led, guided, and directed until the fullness of God's kingdom can be accomplished. in us and through us. And so, again here, I think of those sermons and times past and things that Mr. Armstrong said about government, things we need to understand. And he always made it very clear. He made it clear that Satan was put on this earth to govern this earth. And then he rebelled against God because of God's plan that was going to take place. And then Satan tried to destroy it all. But he was still here for a great purpose that we're going to delve into more and more at this feast that is so profound, so incredibly awesome to understand some of the things that God is giving to us now. Job 1, verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was perfect and upright, and one who feared God and loathed evil. Now, it doesn't mean he was perfect in the sense of absolute perfection in life. Not at all. Doesn't mean that he was without any spiritual fault, because there were things he didn't understand spiritually until later on in his life, or till later on through the story in the book of the book of Job, because there were things he didn't understand in the beginning. And so, but as far as the outward physical part of the righteousness of the law, he lived it. He was very strong in the sense of his ability as a human being to, as far as self is concerned, self-regulation of his own life is concerned, he was a very strong individual in that sense of being able to regulate his own life and actions of his life and what he did. Not talking about the mind, talking about how he regulated his life. And one who feared God. He feared to go against things that God had said or that God had given, knowledge that he had about God. And there wasn't a lot at this point in time, in the sense of understanding what was going to happen later on with a nation called Israel. And what was going to happen later on through time with the prophets. He didn't live during that period of time. That was stuff that came later. And he loathed evil. I think about us sometimes, just as a part of life. How much do we loathe evil? I hope by the time we get through this Feast of Tabernacles, we truly loathe evil much more than what we do and our part in it. Because we participate in human life. We participate in evil. And we need to see evil for what it is. And Satan is the epitome of what is evil. He is the definition of everything that's evil in life. And it starts in the mind. And it's how we think that determines what evil is. And so I hope by the end of the feast, that's why in the series we had about peace and other things, when we can come to see that certain things we say are nothing but evil and sick and perverted, then we won't want those things in our life. We won't do those things. But you've got to see the evil and hate it with all of your being before you quit doing it as human beings. And we've got to see things that we say about people or to people in the light of being evil when it's evil. When it's wrong to see it as being to where the word evil just makes you sick when you say it, when you recognize something that happens. Two people who can't get along in God's church, that's evil. And we need to see it for that, how sick and perverted and ugly it is. And if it makes us feel that way, we won't do it. But ever since I've given the sermon on peace, I continually hear of evil in God's church. People who can't get along. People who say bad things to each other, about each other. How can that be in God's church? Because we don't hate evil enough. I'm not trying to get on to you. I'm just trying to show you what it means to hate evil. To loathe evil. Because it's the mind of this being. Do you want any part of that mind in you? I don't. I want to get rid of it. I abhor it, and I don't want it in me, and I don't want it in any of God's people. But you have to make the choice as to how much and to whether or not your conviction is strong enough to where you hate evil, and you see it as that sign, that being, to loathe that kind of mind, that kind of thinking that hurts. There's been so much hurt in 6,000 years. People have done such demented, twisted, distorted things to one another. You know, sometimes when you go to places that go back in history 500 years, 1,000 years, and they have some of these places sometimes, you can go to a castle in England as an example. We don't have anything that old in the U.S. And that goes back that far. And you can go into some of these places, and they have places where people did torture. And they put these things out on show, the kinds of things they did to each other or did to people, the kinds of contraptions they would put people in and the things they would do to them. And you think, how could a being treat another human being that way? And yet they did it. And their minds were ghoulish and perverted and sick because they had so much influence of the mind of this being in them. So to loathe evil, what a blessing to loathe evil. And so Job loathed evil. It's a beautiful thing to loathe evil, to loathe it with all of your being, to despise it, to hate it. And the more you hate certain things in life that are sin, you won't do them. If you hate something, you're not going to do it. We do it because we enjoy it. I used to tell people that when they still were smoking. You know, if you have a battle with smoking, battle it, fight it, conquer it. You know, it's a small thing in the scheme of things. But people have, that shows how what kind of a force something, a little smoking weed can have. You know, a little smoke coming up from the end. And you know, oh, that's so good. Anyway, you know, it'll kill you. Killed my father. 10 years of sick emphysema in life. You know, watching someone dwindle away in life. It's a horrifying thing. I hate it. But some people don't. They love it. And I used to tell people they had a problem. I said, the problem is you don't. You still love it. Oh, no, I don't love it. I don't love it. No, I don't. Yes, you do. You don't understand. You still love it. When you come to hate it, well, anyway. And sometimes people just don't understand things like that. It's that simple. It's that basic in life. The things we still do that are wrong, we still love. You can deny it. You might not by knowledge. You might say, no, I hate that. But if you do it, there's still a love for it. That's why you're still doing it. And that's a hard thing for the human mind to come to understand. Anyway, if I don't get going, we'll never finish today's sermon. Number two, or verse two, going on here. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters, 10 children. His substance also was 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 female donkeys and very great household, you know, servants and different ones that were there, hired, you know, employees. So that this man was the greatest of all men in the East. And his sons went and feasted in their houses, every one in his day. There have been a lot of speculation on this and what it is. And some people have used this to say, see, you can't observe birthdays. Because this was about their birthdays and they went and celebrated their birthdays. So you can't have any observation of a birthday. That's not what this teaches. That's not what this proves. You can't twist scriptures and distort things to fit your kind of thinking. You know, there's nothing wrong with the observation, with the recognition of a birthday or an anniversary. But some of us became so unbalanced, we became self-righteous in areas we shouldn't have been righteous in because there's no righteousness in it. It's a matter of balance and soundness of mind, you know. And so I think of anniversaries and people getting all, you know, you can't celebrate. If you don't recognize when you got married, you're in trouble. Many a men have gone down that path and burned. Because men don't remember things or think of things in the same way or as well as men, women do. And don't hold them and cherish them in the same way sometimes. And there are some lessons in that. Okay? Don't want to go off on a sermon there. But the same thing as with a birthday. What mother will not remember the birth of her child, the day they were born? What a horrible thing! To say you can't remember that, or you can't observe that, or you can't recognize that with your own child. To me, that's an abomination. But sometimes we become righteous and we think that something shouldn't be done, and so we prohibit everything about that day. That's not sound. It's not wise. It's not balanced. And so again, going on. I'm just pointing out some things here because this was a major scripture to prove. They were out feasting and celebrating on their birthday. And I'm not talking about having great celebrations and inviting a lot of people in to bring presents. That's not sound. There are things in life that are balanced and fine and sound. God teaches moderation. And that's what we should strive for. Anyway, going on. So his sons went and feasted in their houses, everyone in his day. Very possibly their birthday, very probably their birthday. And would send to invite their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them.
And it was so, and it doesn't even go into talk about, it was a feast. You know, there are feast days where people did the same. You'd realize on the Feast of Tabernacles, people feast and drink. Now, they shouldn't overdrink. They shouldn't drink to being beyond moderation. But that's what the feast days are about. It's about celebrating. When God brings us together, He calls certain periods of time, times of feasting. He wants us to feast. He wants us to eat better at this time of year than we do normally. That's why we're able to save all year long. And whatever we've been blessed with, we can do better. You know, and that's what it's about. The ability to grow and produce and be blessed by God to where we can do more and more. And then in the feast time, we're able to feast more. That's what God desires. He desires for us to naturally rejoice. And just in case you missed the mark, He says, I command you to rejoice. You know, we're to focus on rejoicing before God. And so anyway, all of them came together in the time of their, it says, so when the time of their feasting was over, that Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, this is Job's spirit and his attitude, just in case, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed, or in other words, it means to act against God in their hearts. Maybe they didn't drink in moderation. Maybe they said something or did something and didn't control their life and the things they said in the way that they should have. So just in case, I'm going to offer these up before God for them. Thus did Job continually. That was his custom. That's how Job strove in all of his life to obey and to live God's way of life, and even for his family. And so it wasn't that Job had knowledge that they were doing wrong things, but just in case one of his sons might have said something or done something, or maybe had an extra beer or two or whatever it was and didn't follow moderation like he should have. Therefore, I offer this up before God. Verse 6. Now there was a time when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Eternal, speaking of the angelic realm, and Satan also came among them. And the Eternal, Yahweh, said to Satan, where have you come from? You know, God knows everything and everyone does. It's like Adam and Eve when they're walking through the garden and they got in the thick of the brush and so God wouldn't see them. It's like, oh, He made you. He knows you. Anyway. Then Satan answered the Eternal and said, I'm going back and forth on the earth and from walking up and down on it. Now, what is shown here is some big attitude. Some big attitude that this being had toward God. And that's the crux of all this. And how he answered his Creator, his God. Sometimes it's good to remember what his name means. And the name God has used to describe him, Satan, the adversary, the one who resists, the one who opposes God. That's who he is, and he carried that attitude with him. In this particular account here, there's absolutely no respect of any kind being shown in the answer. You know, I've had people answer me that way, you know, within the church about certain things. Won't tell you the whole story about something. They kind of give you something because they want to tell you a part of something that might be partially true. Yeah, he's wandering up and down the earth, but he didn't tell you what he's really doing. He didn't come out and acknowledge what he'd done, what he'd been doing, and so forth. That wasn't what he was going to do. He wasn't about to do that. He's just going to tell a partial story here and basically ends up being a liar because he won't tell the truth. And so he's carrying great attitude here. So there's no respect of any kind, no recognition of God's authority in his life. He didn't acknowledge God's authority in his life. His answer reflects that. Those who are faithful to God, their answers, their response to their Creator will reflect their belief, what they think, how they are, how they think toward their God. There's no attitude here of answerability, that he owed anything to God in answering his God. Yeah, incredible. No thought of anything owed to God. It's kind of an attitude of society in the world today, isn't it? No thankfulness. No thankfulness whatsoever. This being had none. Incredible
to think about that kind of mind. That's why we addressed in the series of sermons here, thankfulness, gratefulness to God, that we need to even think about those things and focus upon those things and pray about those things, because even we in our life, if we're not careful, we become lax in that area and we don't think about the things of the glory of God and what it means to honor Him, to thank Him, to praise Him, to recognize everything we have and everything that we're going to have that He wants to share with us comes from Him. It's being reflected, none of that. Only total selfishness and that of being self-consumed. That's who He was. Total selfishness and one of being totally self-consumed. The spirit whereby He has influenced and ruled the world. Move people to become selfish and totally self-consumed. It's the same spirit. He's the expert at it. And so He's moved mankind to have the same spirit, the same mind, the same attitude. Going on, verse 8. And the Eternal said unto Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him in the earth? A perfect and an upright man, one who fears, in other words, respects God and loathes evil. Now this is kind of cutting to Satan, because Satan wasn't like that, and he didn't like anyone else like that, especially human beings. He loathes human beings. He always has loathed human beings. He hates us with a passion. He truly does. We're little cockroaches to him. That's what he looks at us as. Little roaches. Do you like roaches close to you? On your plate? Close to your plate and your food and in your bed? No. And he doesn't like human beings anywhere around him, because he thinks things belong to him. Then Satan answered the Eternal and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Don't you think there's something in this for him? That's why he does what he does. Yeah. So he even here a smirky attitude that he had. Haven't you made a hedge, meaning a wall of protection, about him and about his house and about all that he has on every side? And you know what? There are blessings to obeying God. God does protect you. God does give you favor. He gives you prosperity. Job was blessed mightily because he obeyed God. There are laws that you obey and live by and that God gives. It's an incredible thing. But that isn't how it started out. That isn't why it was done. It was done because of his response to his God. You have blessed the work of his hands. And it's true. God did. And his substance is increased in the land. But now put forth your hand and touch all that he has, and he'll curse you to your face. You just hear the smugness in Satan, in his attitude toward God. Just touch him. And put your hand on him, and he's going to curse you to your face. In other words, he's going to turn against you. And the Eternal said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. That's some scary stuff. Only do not put forth your hand upon him. An awesome thing that God allowed to happen here in life. See? Because what Job was going to experience and what God was going to allow Satan to do was far more valuable for Job than his loss. Because his loss isn't lost. Because of God's plan for the future, even the great white throne. God goes beyond the moment to that which goes into eternity, that which goes into the future, and has the big picture of our lives and of everyone's life, and what he can accomplish and what he's going to do, what he's going to offer. We still have choice, obviously. Everyone has choice through the process. But it's so awesome what God gives. And the Eternal said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power, but do not put forth your hand upon him. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Eternal. And there was a day when the sons and the daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and a messenger came into Job and said, the oxen were plowing, and the donkeys feeding beside them. And the Sabians fell upon them and took them away. Yes, they have slain the servants by the edge of the sword, and only I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the fire of God has fallen from heaven and has burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And only I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, so bad news upon bad news upon bad news. And while he was yet speaking, there came another also and said, the Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and fell upon the camels and have carried them away. Yes, and have slain the servants by the edge of the sword. And only I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, there came another also and said, your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And behold, there came a wind from the wilderness and destroyed the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead. And only I alone am escaped to tell you. One day, in one moment of time, everything wiped away. Incredible. Family, servants, belongings. So Job arose and tore his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped. Worship God. Turn to God. No matter what happens in life, what an example. Turn to God. And this is before Job's spiritual conversion. He didn't see God yet. He didn't grasp and see things in the way that you come to see them later on in life through conversion. Job wasn't there yet. He was being brought to conversion, to where God could work with him and mold and fashion him for a future purpose and a future government. And said, I came out naked from my mother's womb, and naked I have returned. The Eternal gave, and the Eternal has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Eternal. In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God foolishly. He didn't criticize or judge God. I've known of people who have gone through trials who charge God foolishly. It's like it's God's fault. Why isn't God answering me? Why isn't God preventing this from happening in my life? Why? What does God owe you? Are you alive? Are you able to grow spiritually? What is of great value to you? What you have right now? What you can keep a hold of right now? Or what God is molding and fashioning into you for the future? Because that's what Job was all about. It was what God was preparing him for the future. In a great government that's far more important to help billions of people in the future. So what's more important, your temporary belongings and temporary life, or what God is going to mold and fashion inside of you? Sometimes I cringe when I hear people talking like that. And I've heard people talk like that, not occasionally. I've heard it far too often within the Church of God. When people have these doubts and wonders, why does God allow this to happen? Why is God letting this happen? And it's like, I don't agree with God. God's wrong. Why don't you just say that? God's wrong. I'm not getting what I want. You know, I'm sorry, but that's the way it comes across. We feel sorry for ourselves. We get our little violins. And can I get someone else to have a pity party with me too? Won't you come along and moan my song too? You know, we feel sorry for ourselves. You think, why do we do these things? To the point of blaming God, our creator, our sustainer, the one who wants to bless us abundantly? And Job just said, God gives and God takes away. Because God knows what He's doing. My life is His. And I know that whatever I go through, whatever I experience, God's in charge. And God knows what He's doing and what He's molding and fashioning. I don't have the foggiest idea. Yeah. Would I choose to have gone through some of the heartache and things I've gone through, just like I mentioned at the airport and meeting an individual that brings back so much pain and suffering and sorrow of so many friends who are scattered and torn and dispersed in the world, who I know now can't be a part of a millennial period within a ministry because of an example and because of something that has to be set there, close friends, you know. that I felt close to, went to God's house side by side in counsel blended sweet, but because of this being and because of his influence and what happened and because of others out there who yielded themselves to that being and did evil in God's church, that I've ever chosen to go through those things? No, but I am so thankful to God that I have. For every trial, for every hardship, for every gut-wrenching moment, because they have made me who I am. God made me who I am, and God will make you who you will become in time. Whoever you are that's going into the government of the 144,000, whoever you are that are going to live on into the millennium and have an opportunity to be in that next phase of God's government and God's kingdom, to serve in the great white throne. What an awesome thing. The billions over thousands of years are going to be resurrected. And you're going to have a great part in helping them in their lives to become a part of the God family. It's an incredible thing. It truly is. And so who are we to dispute, to disagree with God Almighty? I'll tell you what. I hope by the end of the series of sermons, this Feast of Tabernacle, we're all going to grow. We're all going to see and receive things in different levels because of where we are spiritually. Because there are some things when you get to a point in life where the more spiritual things become in the sense of what God gives to us, what we're able to see depends on where we are in our growth and our development at a particular time. I am so awesomely excited about where we are. I'm so awesomely excited about what God is giving. I find it hard to write about it. When I was writing, I had a difficult time writing about it, especially the last chapter, or the four chapters, of being able to put into words to describe something so incredibly awesome that I am seeing, but I have a hard time giving the words. And some things, candidly, God hasn't even given to us yet. But he's allowing us to see him more and more, the seventh thunder, more and more. It's powerful. It's awesome. It's incredible. There are things that go beyond words. There are some things that go beyond even the ability of the human mind. And it depends on what God gives us to be able to receive. Anyway, going on here. So what an attitude that Job had. What an awesome attitude. You know? So sometimes any of you, if you ever get to a point in feeling sorry for yourself and feeling bad, and I know there are times we feel bad, but never, never, never blame God. Never find fault with God or why he's not changing something in your life or making something better in your life. Because what he's giving to you is far more valuable than what you can even begin to comprehend if you yield to it. Or otherwise you're going to resist it and throw it all away and not be able to receive any of it. What a horrible thing. Anyway, I fully lost my place. Okay. What verse am I on? I'm on chapter 2? Okay, I see it. Thank you. Verse 22 of the last chapter. In all this, Job did not sin nor charge. In other words, criticize or judge God foolishly. Chapter 2. Again, there was a time when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Eternal. And Satan also came among them in the presence. So same thing again. Here we go again. And here's that being again. And the Eternal said unto Satan, where have you come from? Same old attitude. Didn't change. He doesn't change. Same attitude since the day he sinned. Then Satan answered the Eternal and said, from going back and forth on the earth and from walking up and down on it. What a smug attitude. I mean, he just reeks with smugness and attitude. And the Eternal said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? That there's no one like him on the earth, a perfect and an upright man. You know, God is able to say it again before him. A perfect. It's like putting a sword in Satan. Because he couldn't stand it. You would think, what a miserable life to live life like that. It reminds me of people talking last night about some who put things out there on the internet. They live miserable, unhappy life. There are people listening to me, well, not right now because we're not broadcasting live. But when this is put on the system here today, there are going to be people out there that listen for no other purpose than to find fault, to criticize, to. And you think, get a life, go fishing, learn how to surf. Do something. Enjoy life. Why torment yourself with what I'm saying? but they like to do that. It's a perversion, a sickness of mind. They don't even understand what they're doing to their own lives. They're not happy people. They're miserable and unhappy. They just want to see me destroyed. They want to see an end come to me. They want to see me fall on my face. They want to see anything that can happen to me. And they'll relish in that. Well, they've got to wait about a year and a half. And then they can be a part of the crowd that sends around some presents. You know, finally, it's happened. They can write on their blog, "Oh, he finally got what he deserved. They took care of him. You know, he shouldn't have gone there. He shouldn't have been there. Dumb, dumb, dumb." Anyway, you can't understand minds like that because they're so unsound. They're so perverted and so sick, and they don't know who they're yielding themselves to. Yes, you're yielding yourself to Satan. They're going to love that one. Anyway, it's true. You are. You're making yourself his sons. Incredible. And the Eternal said unto Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on the earth. He's an upright man, fears and respects God, and loathes evil." See, because Satan didn't loathe evil. God knows that about him. "And he still holds fast to his integrity. Although you moved me against him to destroy him without cause." There was no cause. No just cause against him. "But you moved me to do this. You moved me to allow you to do this." But you know, in the midst of all this, by the end of the sermon series at the feast here, to realize what God was doing, that Satan here was a pawn. He was a little bitty pawn to help accomplish something great in Job's life. That's something Satan never has gotten, still doesn't get, can't get. Say. And so, again, God is blessing me to be able to speak strong and powerfully about these things, because this isn't all about the church of God. It's also about this being and where God has brought him to, finally. After millions and millions and perhaps billions, we don't know how many years of time, earth's time. "And Satan answered the eternal and said, skin for skin. Yes, if all that a man has, he will give for his life. But now put forth his hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he'll curse you to your face. Bring him to the point of death, and he'll curse you. And the eternal said to Satan, behold, he's in your hand, but save his life." Take him right up to the edge, but save his life. Don't take his life. So, Satan went from the presence of the Eternal and struck Job with sore boils from the bottom of his foot to the top of his head. And he took him, this Job here, a broken piece of pottery and scraped himself with it, and he sat down among the ashes. And then his wife said to him, "Do you still retain..." She was a great help. "Do you still retain your integrity? Just curse God and die." Boy, that's exciting. You know, that's great moral support. No compassion and feeling here in this particular case. Anyway. "But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speak. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive bad?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Incredible. Incredible. The integrity that he did have. I admire it. But it was on a physical plane. It was without the Spirit of God. It was just something he did by his own willpower. I don't have that kind of willpower. You know, I don't have that kind of willpower. He wasn't righteous in the sense of righteousness spiritually before God. That's another matter. Going on here. A week ago, I'm not going to go through the rest of the story here. There are more here. But again, it just shows how Satan has continually worked through time. It's an attitude of mind. He's continually tried to destroy anything with mankind. He hates and loathes mankind. And he hates especially anyone who has any possibility of any kind of relationship with God. He can't stand it. He can't take it. It just eats. It's like a cancer. It just eats away at him. And so he strikes out wherever he can. And here, he loved this. He loved being able to strike out at Job But again, he was a pawn, and he didn't even know he's a little pawn. But God uses that in a very powerful way for a powerful purpose that Satan can't comprehend. That has to do with the growth and formation of God's family, Elohim. It's an awesome thing. Let's go over to 1 Chronicles. Example after example, over and over and over again in Scripture, of things that Satan has done through time to strike out at mankind, to strike out at those that God was using through time in his plan and so forth. And here's the story of King David. 6,000 years of this on earth. 6,000 years this being has been stirring up and causing problems and causing hurt in nations and peoples and wars and all the evil and filth that's out there. He loves it. He loves to see human beings suffer. He's got such a perverted, sick mind. Truly does. He's perverted every kind of religion that's out there, every kind of belief that's out there, to torment, to hurt people's minds, to cause problems between nations. Religion is the cause of so many problems between nations. It's what you believe as you grow up, and those prejudices then you use against others who don't think the same way you do. And so people strike out at each other in hatred, in deep hatred. And that, where does that end? Depends on how far they carry it. Verse Chronicles 21 and verse 1. And Satan stood up against Israel. He did it over and over again. But when he took a stand, when he would work and manipulate and try to do things, and here's one that he influenced King David. You know, you have to be careful. People have to be alert that they're not, that they don't yield themselves as a result of sin, because whenever sin comes in the picture, you take yourself away from God, and you can be influenced by a wrong broadcast, by wrong thinking. And this happened to King David. It says, and Satan stood up against Israel and provoked, the word here means to entice or to allure or to persuade David to number Israel. Now, sometimes people ask me, and this is the reason we don't do it. Sometimes people ask me, how many people in the church? And I tell them, I don't know. I don't want to know, because it's not about numbers. There was an organization I was with before. The big thing was numbers. We even joke about it and we laugh about it in some of the areas, because some got in trouble because they didn't count enough people in their services, because it became a thing of pride and haughtiness within the ministry. How many people do you have in your church? Oh, I have. Oh, and then it gets around. And if you don't have the same number of people in your church, you don't say anything. I don't have that many people in our church, are you? So you're better than I. You're bigger. You're farther up here than I am. That's what it became. That's what, I witness this over and over and over again within the ministry. You think, how can this be God's church? The big thing becomes, you know, it used to be, you know, maybe there were 500, 600 in a congregation, or maybe a person had two congregations, and one in the morning and one in the afternoon, and one had 350, one had 400 in it, 750 people. Woo-hoo-hoo! Anyway, sorry. He was really big. But anyway, that's what it became. And then all of a sudden we had a scattering. And then 100 sound big. It did. It got, you know, if a congregation, if there's 100, the same guy that had maybe 700 before, now there's only 100 in his congregation, that was big because of the scattering. And there was still haughtiness and pride in it. And sure enough, then what happens? You know, people as a whole, I can tell you, close, within a thousand or so. How many are in each of the big groups out here? Why? Because they like to publish it. The big one especially. They count a lot of numbers out here. They really work up the numbers because that's a big thing to them. And that's important to them. And that's not a pleasing thing to God. Because it becomes a matter of pride and haughtiness. Why are you using that? Why do you continue to push that? Why in congregations do you push from one area to another area? How many are in a particular area? That's not of God. What kind of a mind is doing it? What is the purpose behind those kinds of things? So, and that's what God is concerned with. He's concerned with a mind. Is it a matter of something that lifts you up and becomes a matter of pride? You know, even when the numbers, even when we were scattered and the numbers were small, you think, why should you have haughtiness and pride over having 20,000 people? Big, big deal. What does that mean? Are you all close to God? Do you all have a close relationship with God? Are you all united at one with God? It's better to have two that are fully united with God than to have several thousand who aren't. So it depends upon our relationship with God. That's what counts. It's not about numbers. It never is with God. That's why the world can't grasp today about numbers. And even when they talk about worldwide, you know, having 150,000 people total at the height, that's nothing compared to Protestant churches who have millions. Different groups in the world, they still think, oh, you're a sect. Oh, 150,000 people, you're a sect. You're so small. You're a sect. Sect is evil. You belong to this little sect. But if you had several million and you belong to one of the bigger ones, you know, that's kind of acceptable. Anyway, sick world, sick minds. So I don't care if there's 100, 200, 300, which we were in that neighborhood for years and years and years. We knew an approximation because when you're that small, you have a fairly good... But to know the exact number, to tell people, what's the point? And as we've continued to grow, that's why I mentioned make comment. We've had 3 or 4 times the growth in the last 3 years, and that just shows that that's exciting and inspiring, but to know the numbers, that's not important. Don't worry about it. After a while, it doesn't mean a thing. When thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon tens of thousands upon hundreds of thousands are going to be baptized and brought into God's church. Amazing how the human mind works. And so David was going to number Israel. Why? Power. How much power do we have? So are you looking to yourself and to your own ability as in the power, and you have something you're lifted up by as far as the numbers, and does that give you greater confidence? Or does the fact that God fights your battles and gives you favor, and that's where your power is? Do you look to self or to God? Do you look to numbers or do you look to God? What is important? And David said to Job and to the rulers of the people, go, number Israel, take a census. Now this had to do with the military. This had to do with the might of the people. From Beersheba even unto Dan, and bring the number of them to me that I may know it. And Job answered, the Eternal is able to make his people 100 times more than they are. This upset Job. Or Joab, sorry. Joab. It upset him because he felt this wasn't right. He said, because God is able to make our numbers greater. In other words, against the nations around. This is what it's about. It's about this power, about might, about other nations in relationship with them. But my Lord the King, are they not all my Lord's servants? Why then does my Lord require this thing? Why will you cause Israel to sin? Because if you, the king, lift this up in importance, then people are going to follow that example, and this is what's they're going to do the same thing. They're going to think this is what's important. See? If you make this an important thing and a matter of something that we look to for encouragement, for boldness, for strength, then... And he was right. Verse 4, nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab. Wherefore Joab departed and went throughout all Israel, and he obeyed the king and came to Israel. And Joab gave the sum of the number to the people unto David. And all Israel, there were 1,100,000 men who could draw a sword. So what is it about? The men who could draw a sword, their might, their military, and their ability to go out and fight others. And in Judah, 470,000 men who could draw a sword. But he did not count Levi and Benjamin among them, for Joab was so abhorred at the king's word. So even here he didn't fully follow what he said, but he brought back other numbers and told him. And God was displeased with this thing, and he therefore punished Israel, because David made Israel to sin in this. And it's a good thing to think about sometimes. Think about things about relationship with God and what God says, and even with a nation of people and with a king here, and their responsibility, his responsibility to lead properly and to keep focused on God. God is our king. That's what it says in the Old Testament. God, Yahweh Elohim, is our King of Kings. That's what it says. You know, it used to be a time we thought that was only about Jesus Christ. No, that was given him as a title later on for ruling on this earth. But God Almighty is first and foremost Lord of Lords and King of Kings. So says the Old Testament over and over. I have sinned greatly because I have done this thing. So David said to God, he finally acknowledges, he says, I have sinned greatly in that I have done this thing. But now I implore you that you do away with the iniquity of your servant. In other words, forgive me of the sin, for I have done very foolishly. Oh, what a blessing. You know, when we do sin and we do something stupid and foolish, that we can go before God and ask for forgiveness. And especially within the church, it's an awesome thing. Sometimes we don't recognize how great and how powerful this truly is of what God has given to us. And the Eternal spoke to Gad, David's seer, in other words, his spiritual guide and prophet, if you will, saying, go and tell David, saying, thus says the Eternal, I am going to place before you three choices. Choose one of them, and that's what I'll do unto you. Interesting here what took place too, just as a side story going on here. But again, remember, Satan was behind all this. Satan is the one who broadcast and persuaded and influenced David to do this in the first place. He was the one that put the thoughts. You know, there's a tremendous power that being has to broadcast in the air, to broadcast and magnify attitudes or doubts or whatever it might be that we have. And it's like a radio broadcast. You know, until we had radio waves, and it says he's the prince of the power of the air, you know, there are things we didn't grasp and comprehend, but we understand them better now. Because especially when Mr. Armstrong came to understand there's a spirit essence in the mind of man that makes us unique, that gives us the ability to think and reason and be different from the animal kingdom, if you will. And he talked about that spirit essence that's able to receive spirit broadcasts from others, from demons, from Satan. They can put thoughts, they can broadcast in the air. And it's up to us to choose or reject. Sometimes thoughts come into your mind, they're not just necessarily from you. They're not of your mind. You know, they come from broadcasts. It's like you've got this channel going, you know. You know, you're changing channels over. And you catch something out here, and you don't like it, you don't want it. Well, just reject it then. It's not yours. You don't act upon it. It's not sin. It's when you act upon it. It's when you take it and begin to work with it and begin to think about it and dwell upon it. It becomes sin. And that's what they want. They want to lead you astray. They want to cause you to come to sin. And that's what David did. He started thinking about it, and sure enough, it's a good idea. No, it isn't. Just like God. He broadcasts to our minds once we're drawn by Him, once we're, especially when we're baptized. And that's why it's so important to keep a close relationship with Him. So just like today, right now he's broadcasting to you, because what you're hearing is not just a matter of words. If you just heard words, I could go out here and get on TV and tell you and give them the same sermon. Zilch. Upstairs. Nothing. You would just think, man, that guy's, he's animated. He's excited about what he's saying, but man, that's really far out, isn't it? They might listen for the entertainment value. I've never seen anything quite like this, you know. But they wouldn't get it. They wouldn't understand what you understand. What you understand is being given by God, not by me. It's by God's Spirit. What an awesome thing. By God's Spirit, we're able to hear beyond the words. We're able to digest with understanding. It's an awesome thing, God's Spirit. And the spirit essence in the mind. But there's a being out there that likes to broadcast, and he doesn't do it in a good way. It's everything is wrong. Everything that comes into the mind from him is wrong. And you reject it. And the closer you are to God, the less he can broadcast to you. Awesome. Or the quicker you can reject it too. So again here, he said, you have three choices. So Gad went to David and said to him, thus says the Eternal, choose one. Either, number one, 3 years famine. Number two, 3 months to be destroyed from your foes while the sword of your enemies overtakes. Or number three, or else this, 3 days, the sword of the Eternal, even with the pestilence of the land and the angel of the Eternal destroying throughout all the coast of Israel. Now therefore choose what word I should bring again to him who sent me. And David said to Gad, I am in a desperate situation. Let me now fall into the hand of the Eternal, for his mercy is very great. What an awesome thing here, the attitude of David, the spirit of David. He says, let me fall into God's mercy. Let me fall into his hand and his mercy. And don't let me fall into the hands of man. So rather than it being conquered by the enemies and so forth, or having enemy come in like that, he said, just let it be of God. So the Eternal sent pestilence upon Israel, and there fell in Israel 70,000 men. Some people look on this and say, oh, how horrible that is. Well, they're going to be resurrected one day in a great white throne. Because you see, God was working with an individual here, his mind, someone who is going to be in his government later on, that is a far greater value than 70,000 lives. And that's sometimes hard for us to understand. We think, well, that's not fair. Yes, it is. Because their life in this world, you know, sometimes we just don't get it. For someone to live a full life in this life, in this world, in the last 6,000 years, what kind of a blessing has that been? The blessing comes in the great white throne. When it's God's world. When it's God's government and God's church and the power and the Spirit of God is full on the earth. And the people who are resurrected, you know what they have to do? They have to fight what they were in the world before. And the longer they lived and the more evil they lived and experienced, the harder it is to overcome. That's why I'm thankful I was called at 19. You know, I had enough already from the world. And the more, the older we are, once we're called, and especially if you're called out of religion in the world, the harder it is. I talk to people. I'm thankful I never grew up in religion, going there week after week and being bombarded with all their garbage and swill and perversion, you know. If I went once a year, you know, a few times a year, just with some friends or whatever, I didn't really know what they were teaching and the like anyway. And I was blessed in that. I was blessed by not being fully immersed. And so some people who've been around that all their lives, you know what their battle is for the rest of their life? Coming out of some of those things. Those of you who are called, the longer you've been in this world, in the flesh, and lived in certain things in the world, it's a battle conquering and overcoming it, isn't it? It's not easy. It's hard. It truly is. It's a lifelong battle. A baby that dies a year old, that's resurrected in the great white throne. They don't have anything in their minds that have perverted their minds. When they wake up, they're so fresh. When God gives them life and they're able to live 100 years on this earth, what a beautiful life. Not having to fight and conquer some of the sins they experienced and that they did, the evil they did on other people. No, they grow up with a fresh mind, a mind that's able to be filled with the ways of God. And some people just don't understand the blessing of that. They're really far better off in so many ways. And there's different purpose of what God does in life and what He gives to us and what He molds and fashions in us. So anyway, another sermon, and we'll probably hear one on the subject. But do you understand what I'm saying? The differences. 70,000 people died. They were going to die anyway. They were going to die anyway. At some point along the way. What age were they when they died? 20, 30, 50, 60, 70, 80? Yes, probably within that range. All of them who died within that range. 70,000 people who were going to die in this period of 6,000 years anyway. Okay. But God had a greater purpose for it, for what He was doing in one purpose. And I hope you can understand the value and the importance of that and for their life and how fair and how righteous that is before God. Because do we understand, before you are quick to judge, do you understand you don't deserve more life at all from the first moment you have sinned? From the first moment you have sinned, do you know what you deserve as a human being? Do you really grasp what you deserve as a human being? Do we really understand? We think God owes us life. That He owes us something. And He gave us life. Well, how great is that? But when we sin against Him, it's death. It's eternal death. And again, I hope by the end of the sermons at this feast you come to appreciate and understand that more deeply. The beauty and the might of God Almighty and His love and His purpose for mankind. Because, see, you don't really think you deserve death the first time you sin. That's the problem. You don't think that's what we're deserving of. See, sometimes that's what we think. We don't think, I guess I really am deserving of death. But I think He'll leave me around for 60 more years. That's what I think I really deserve that, to at least be around for 60 more years or 40 more years. No, you deserve death instantly. But God doesn't give that to you. He lets you live on in the world. But there has to come a point in time when you can be forgiven of that, and that's why Jesus Christ came. So you can be forgiven not of just one sin, but for thousands and thousands of your own sins. We deserve death, human beings do. It doesn't take very long. But you hear more about that in sermons as we go along. Things like this force you, if you will, to think about God, to seek to understand God and what He's doing and His purpose and His plan, over 7,100 years. What he's working out. What do we deserve and what do we not deserve? If we're not careful, we can become like Satan in our thinking. In thinking that God owes us certain things. When he's placed before us a golden platter. He truly has. God Almighty has. And in time, we'll be able to receive from that platter, if you will. But in time, as a whole, for the first 6,000 years, it was never meant that man would be able to be saved. He would live and die and be resurrected in a different world, a beautiful world. And only out of that 6,000 years, 144,000 plus those at the end here that are added to that, that get to live on into a new age. So again here, 70,000 people died. Satan stirred Israel to sin against God, and they suffered mightily for it. Over and over again, Israel suffered for rebelling against God, for not obeying God. And you want to know what else is far more important then? Is what it does when people understand we have sinned against God and we must have a right fear and awe and respect to God because He has the power of life as to whether we continue to live and are blessed to continue to live on this earth or not. And so when people are moved, when a nation was moved, 70,000 people die and you know what? Everybody knows it. Everybody knows large numbers of people have died. And they are moved to sobriety and to saying, I want a right relationship with God. I want to fear God and honor God. I want to obey God. You know, it kind of gives a little bit of motivation, doesn't it? To be able to be blessed. What a horrible thing that man has to be motivated to be blessed by God. You know, to be sobered to sobriety so that you'll obey God so that God will bless you. Because if they continued in their course, they would drift farther and farther away from God and truly suffer more, and more would die just because of disobedience to God through time. Nations would come in and conquer them because God would remove His blessings and His protection. It would happen. It happened again and again and again. Whenever they disobeyed God, God took away His blessings. And what happened when God took away His blessings? Nations came in and conquered them, you know, overthrew them, over, you know, kill hundreds, you know, hundreds of thousands of people through time. So what's worse? He said, I'd far rather place myself in the hands of my God than in the hands of man. Great wisdom in that. And great blessings in that. But if you're not careful, you'll only look at the 70,000 and miss the mark and miss the understanding of what God has shown. So anyway, it goes on in the story here. Read some of it as we go along here. I'll just read a little bit more. And so it says, pestilence came, 70,000 people died. And God sent an angel unto Jerusalem to destroy it. And as he was destroying, to cause destruction, in other words, the Eternal looked upon all, and he changed his mind of bringing any more evil, and said to the angel who was destroying, it's enough. Cease now your hand. And the angel of the Eternal stood by the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. And David lifted up his eyes and saw the angel of the Eternal stand between the earth and the heaven, having a drawn sword in his hand stretched out over Jerusalem. And David and the elders of Israel, who were clothed in sackcloth, fell upon their faces. So he humbled himself before God. He fasted before God. And David said to Gad, it is not I, or is it not I, who commanded the people to be numbered? It is I who have sinned and done evil indeed. But as for these sheep, what have they done? Let your hand, I pray you, O Eternal my God, be on me and on my father's house and not on your people, that they should be plagued. He saw that angel about to strike at Jerusalem before he knew that God said, that's all. And he said, it's enough. He said, let it be upon me. He said, it's my sin. That's good. It shows sometimes what it takes for us as human beings to come to a point where we accept the responsibility for our own sin. It's incredible. Where we're willing to accept full responsibility for my sin when we do that in life. And there's a lot to be learned from this. But again, Satan doesn't understand those things. He doesn't understand repentance. He doesn't understand the mercy of God. He doesn't understand how God's working with mankind. It's a dilemma to him. He just sees us like these little roaches, these little bugs, these little pesky things. How could you work with something like that? He's created a spirit being. How could you work with something like that? Look at them. I mean, that's it. He has this total disdain for human beings and for God's creation of human beings. And he has no comprehension how God is creating Elohim. It's an awesome thing. It really is. Awesome. Awesome beyond your comprehension. And only as God gives you some comprehension through time do you come to appreciate it more and more and more. And to become more in awe of what God is doing as you grow. It's an awesome thing. So Satan and demons have consistently worked to torment and destroy mankind. It's always been before them to do this. Over and over. You read about it throughout history. Constantly leading mankind astray. That's what they want to do. They like to see people suffer. They love to see people suffer. They love to see people go off on these weird religious things and do weird things in life and have a form of mockery toward God. You know, every one of them is. Just like Christmas. It's designed to be a mockery toward God. You know, and he's the master of it all. Satan is. Incredible. Different things that have happened through time. Easter, you know, rather than taking of the bread and the wine and washing of feet, let's have these little bunnies out here laying eggs and little children going out and finding eggs on Easter. And anyway, sick world. He's such a sick being, Satan is. He truly is. His mind is so perverted, so sick, so distorted. Has been for millions of years. Constantly seeking to destroy, hurt mankind, fight against God, thwart God's plan, thwart God's purpose, but he doesn't get it. God is almighty. He is God. And Satan, it's hard to understand, he doesn't get it. What a distorted mind. So again, enticing mankind to sin, enjoying mankind sinning, wanting to torment mankind, loving it to see mankind torment each other, loving it when people don't get along, loving it when people get in disputes, loving it when people torture each other, in any, whether it be physical or mental, they love it. They love it. They relish in it. It's like people paying to go to these great big games, whether it be soccer or football or whatever it is, and all these people in the stadiums and watching, like during the Roman period, you know, in the Colosseum. And demons and Satan are like that. Look what they're doing. And they try to cause them to do other things. Sick, perverted minds, loving to watch the destruction, loving to watch the pain and the hurt and the sorrow and the diseases and everything else that they're behind. They truly are. Loving to watch the intellectualism of man as he messes with science, as he messes with different things in science, nature, the hybrids that they make and the things they come up with and the additives they put in their food so the food will last longer, and watching us just get sicker and sicker and cancers and everything else, that things that come from all these things that take place. Loving to watch mankind sin and do sick and perverted things, and all of a sudden you have AIDS so far around the world and sweeping through and killing millions of people in time. They love to see those kinds of things take place because of the perversions of man. And see, that's the way they are. They're worse than animals. See what they do to each other? They love it. Thank God for his plan. Thank God for what he's doing. Thank God for what's ahead. That we're almost to the end of this cesspool of life that man has lived in, with Satan and the demons that are stirring up the cesspool. So they were there from the very beginning, Adam and Eve. Satan's right there. We'll read about that as we go along, you know. Incredible what took place there. Right there, you know, at the flood, all the way up to the time of the flood. Mankind lived for a long period of time up to that point in time. God teaching some very powerful things there, and God talked about the evil of human beings by that point in time. Because you see, if you live 70 years, there's a certain amount of evil that you accumulate in your mind and your thinking and what you're able to do. But when you're able to live several hundred years, and you become expert at evil and manipulation. You know, human beings, by nature, are controlling and manipulative. And people became very professional. You'd be no match for some of those people back then. They were so professional how they were able to manipulate and control. to evil, to their end, to their selfishness. So much so that God said, it's time to destroy it all, except for one family. Incredible. And Satan was there stirring up the pot, leading in all the evil of human beings to where there is such perversion. You know, didn't take long after that. It's all over the earth again. Think about the things that happened right after the flood. Satan was there. Egypt. Egypt. The one great nation as a whole that's not mentioned as much by the time you get to Daniel, because by that time, that period of time was passed, and then God showed the four great kingdoms on the earth that would exist, and then finally this great big cube, as it were, that would come down from heaven and strike the feet of the statue, and it'd fall over, and showing God's kingdom coming to this earth. And some of you remember that picture that was done in a very good way on the telecast that we used to have a long time ago, and very inspiring. And this thing that Daniel saw, and that was there, the statue and so forth. But yet Egypt was one of the first ones after the flood. Great nation. And you know what? There it was. Elohim. Gods. Same word. God families that the Egyptians had. Satan portrayed things as over and over again in different things that are a matter of family. That's why God said in Exodus, when he took the children of Israel, he said, you shall have no other Elohim before me. He used the same word, gods. You shall have no other gods before me. The word is Elohim. Why? Because there's only one Elohim, family of God. And you shouldn't have any others except the one that's true, that's from me. And so he used a word because that's what Satan did. He used families, God families, the different families. And I don't care what kind of period you go into, you know, the different ones were there. Satan made a counterfeit, you know, perverted, distorted, making fun of, mocking God, mocking what God was doing by his false gods. And so it started with Egypt, with Ra. You know, when we were there, went through the museum, went through some of the things about some of their beliefs and so forth, it was dumbfounding just to hear them talk about these different gods and put it in a perspective of something I'd never really known to that degree before. And maybe it hit in a greater way at that point in time, too. Going through and listening to all this stuff and the different kinds of God families and the struggles they had and so forth, and the way it infected and infected an entire nation of people, you know. And so that was just one. Many other kingdoms that came and different ideas that they had and so forth through time. Satan was always there. He was always the one that stirred these things up, influenced these things in the practices and the beliefs, you know. Some really distorted, perverted things out there. And then what happened later on? You get some of those same ideas. You get the Old Testament. He really loved this one. And you kind of put it together and shake it. And out falls Protestantism. You know, really, that's what happened. You take some of the things that happened, and all of a sudden Jesus Christ came along, and you have all these false beliefs out there, and this great big universal church comes along. And they put these different pagan ideas. Easter, Ishtarte, you know, all these different ideas, and you put it all together, and you shake it together. A counterfeit, all these counterfeits with something that God is doing, and you pervert it even more. It's incredible what we've lived through. It's incredible what man has lived through in the last 2,000 years. It's incredible the perversion that Satan put upon mankind to have now a couple billion people whose minds are fully perverted about Christianity, who think they love Jesus, or think they love God, or think they love Mary, or somebody there, you know, some of those beliefs. Thank God that's about ready to get cleaned up. And why? Because of this same being. Look at what he's done. Look at that mind and what he has done through time. That's why I love this Feast of Tabernacles and what God is showing that's going to take place through time with him. You know, it's incredible. It truly is what he's done. So Satan was there with Pharaoh and his sorcerers, you know, when God came along and was working through Moses. Here are these sorcerers doing some things that are beyond human ability, and they had help, and there Satan is, you know, still always there, stirring up, working with Pharaoh. You just go through time. You get down to Israel. I think I wrote some different ones down here. Stirred up Jeroboam to turn toward Baal. You know, a lot of people think that when you come to Sunday worship that it started happening 350 years after Christ. Oh, it was happening way before Christ. You know, and we understand that. But even within Israel, that's the point. Even Israelites were keeping Sunday worship long ago. And it's when Jeroboam and Rehoboam, they had their split. And the south nation of Judah as a whole and the north nation of Israel as a whole, the other 10 nations that were up there, scattered up that region of the area under Jeroboam. And every king that came along, and it says, and they went the ways of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Yeah, that's what's written about them. They did the way of Jeroboam, meaning that they did the same thing as far as religious ideas were concerned, as far as mixing the worship of Baal in with what they'd been given about the God of the Old Testament. And they made a mixture of the two. So the different ideas that have come down through time. And Satan always there. Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 2. Matthew chapter 2. He's always tried to overthrow God's purpose. And that's a... You just have to scratch your head sometimes and think, how... But you can't understand a mind that's perverted. You can't understand that which is unbalanced and unsound. That's what I hate about psychology. That's what I hate about some of the sciences sometimes when they... You know, there's certain behavior that's a science that's understandable, and you can work with that. But when you go beyond that and you try to delve into a person's life and say, what made them turn? When did they... This is a little child and something happened to them, and maybe that's when it all started, and... you know, they go through these rigmarole of trying to understand when the mind became unsound and unbalanced. And if you can get back there, you can work with it and make it right. And no, you can't. Only God can. By the power of His Holy Spirit, by helping a person repent of sin and being able to begin to understand their own heart and mind. You can't help them. You're not going to change them. You're not going to make their life better. You know, we try to do that with Afghanistan. We try to do that with Iraq. We think as a nation in the United States, we can make their lives better. We can give them democracy. Oh, they're voting again in Afghanistan. That's a beautiful picture, isn't it? You know? These people who just love democracy, they want... We want what the United States has. Anyway. Sick, sick, sick. We're so perverted. And so are some things when it comes to psychology and so forth, when people want to get in there and help people to make their minds right. To make them like they are. No, you can't. You can't make them better. Only God can. Only God can heal the mind. And that's what we all need, isn't it? Human beings. Matthew chapter 2 and verse 1. Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east of Jerusalem, saying, where is he who is born king of the Jews? That's an awesome thing that was taking place here. Where is he who is born king of the Jews? Now, you know Herod loved that one. Oh, the Jews have a king? Someone born to be king that you believe? You have this religious belief that someone's born to be your king? For we have seen his star in the east, and we have come to worship him. And of course, I don't even like to talk about it, but I'm going to. I can't pass it up. People in traditional Christianity, they think it's this star up in the sky. And it has this long trail of light, just like it's beaming down on top of a house in Bethlehem. You think, how dumb can you be? But they'd rather believe that than understand what it means. You know, that somehow you're going to get a star close enough to the earth, it's going to fry us all. You know, don't you understand a star is a sun? And some of those are a lot bigger than our sun. How close does it have to get to the earth? And it's so big, and it gets over a little town. How nuts can you be? No, really, we're so stupid as human beings sometimes. And yet, because little kids believe it, and then people grow up believing it, and they put these little stars on their trees, and it's all so sweet and nice. It's perverted. It's of Satan. It's sick. Anyway, we have seen a star in the east. They don't. It's about an angel. They don't understand the symbolism and things that are given here and things that God speaks of in prophecy, things that are prophetic and things that have happened through time. They were told. It says, when Herod the king had heard these things, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Amazing. All Jerusalem with him? Troubled? This news was spreading? This wasn't a small thing. Sometimes you get a little capsule of something, a couple of verses or a couple of sentences, and we don't realize what was taking place in the world at that time. We don't realize what was happening in a particular city at that time. That's why I love going through the series we did this last year about Jesus Christ, especially on the 10th day when he came into Jerusalem and he fulfilled, you know, the lamb being set apart on the 10th day. Beautiful picture. And all the things that were happening and how this moved an entire area, the area of Jerusalem at that time. how people were so moved by the things that they experienced and saw. Going on here, verse 4. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes and the people together, he demanded to them, where are the Christ, the Messiah? They knew what this was about. It was about this king that was to be born. This prophecy about a Messiah that the Jews had, of a Messiah that should be born who was going to rule the Jews, but not just that, but have rulership over the world. There are certain ideas that they had back then. They understood about a Messiah that was going to come and give Israel, or the Judah in this particular case that was remaining, power on the earth to rule. They didn't understand what God was going to do, but they understood this to a point to where to Herod and to others it was a threat. You know, it was a threat that they wanted to get rid of, especially when you have things moved by a religious fervor. You know, there's a lot of persuasion there, and they understood that. And they said to him, in Bethlehem of Judea, it was written by the prophet, that's what is written by the prophet, and you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the princes of Judah, for out of you shall come a leader or a ruler, who shall rule my people Israel. So they understood this was a prophecy in the Old Testament, and that it is going to be a matter of coming from Bethlehem. This is all written and recorded. So they were inspired by God, not to understand the whole plan of God, but to know this, to understand these things, and to say, yes, this is what it says. And this, of course, is a quote from Micah. You don't have to go there, but I'm just going to read it to you. It's Micah. Verse comes out of Micah chapter 5, verse 2. It says, but you, Bethlehem, Ephrath, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth from me, who is to be ruler in Israel, whose going forth has been from old, from everlasting. Meaning in Hebrew, from the days of eternity. This has been planned. This has been purposed. Amazing. It's right there. Speaking of Jesus Christ, who would be born in Bethlehem. Going on, Matthew 2 and verse 7. Then Herod, when he had privately called the wise men, inquired of them diligently what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search diligently for the young child. And when you have found him, bring me word again that I may go and worship him also. Yeah, right. Yeah. What a sicko. You know, he wanted to kill him. That was what his motive was. But he was really nice to the wise men and made them feel good about all this and what their journey they were on, and sent them on their way and said, oh, you know, let me know as soon as you find out, because I want to go down there and worship him too. And you found out who it is, you know. When they had heard the king, they departed. And then the star, which they saw in the east, went before them until it came and stood over where the young child was. So they were able to see this being. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And when they had gone into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented to him gifts, gold and frankincense. So different types of gifts here. In other words, frankincense here, highly valuable and used in incense as well as perfumes and so forth. And myrrh, again, valued for its fragrance and sometimes worth more than the weight of gold at that time. And that's why Judas was a little upset when some of the oils and so forth were put on Jesus Christ there, and he was anointed for his death. And he wanted the money. He was a treasurer, and he had more concern about the money than he did with what was being used for. Verse 12. And being warned of God in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed. So again, here they were warned in the dream, it says. They departed into their own country by another way. And when they had departed, behold, the angel of the Eternal appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise and take the young child and his mother and flee into Egypt and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. And when he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed into Egypt. And so this was already underway. You know, Herod was already moved. There was a being behind all that, a desire to destroy and kill. And you think, it's strange, but anyway, it was already in motion. And so they were warned that this was already taking place, and this is Herod's purpose, and people are going to die. Children are going to die. So it goes on to say in verse 15, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord by the prophet. So all these are matters of prophecy, things that were written long ago to be fulfilled in time, saying, out of Egypt have I called my son. So in time, he'd be called out of Egypt because he was sent to Egypt. Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked by the wise men, he was not a happy man. It doesn't say that here, but he wasn't a happy man. Was exceeding angry and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem and in all the coasts thereof from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. So he's trying to find this time period of when this was to happen and how it happened and so forth. And so he made sure. He was trying to make sure that everyone was wiped out. Then it was fulfilled which was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, in Ramah there was a voice heard, lamentation and weeping and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children. You know what's amazing about so many things in prophecy? You have no inkling, no idea what it applies to until God lets you know what it applies to. You can't go through this and say, oh, this applied to then. It's because God tells you that's what it applied to. He inspired it to be shown that this is what it applied to. Then you can know. There are so many things in prophecy that are that way. You can't know what they're about or what portions are there for a specific moment in time until God says, this is what it's for. This is what it applied to. Amazing. Verse 19. But when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Eternal appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, arise and take the young child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for they are dead who sought the child's life. And he arose and took the young child and his mother, and they went to the land of Jerusalem. So again, one account after another of things that Satan had an involvement in, and swaying rulers, swaying people through time, always trying to thwart and distort, trying to hurt God's plan and purpose, and all the while actually helping it. Every time, all the way through, he's always been there helping. He didn't understand that. It's got to be such an aggravation because everything always, it's kind of like Haman. You know, when you go through and you read the story of Esther, you look how everything turned against him. It's the same thing. Exact same thing. Satan has lived that for 6,000 years. Everything he's tried to do has always come back and slapped him in the face. It's been like a sword stabbing him. It doesn't work out for him. He just likes to destroy, and that's all. That's basically all he can do, and cause hurt and pain and suffering. Because everything that God is doing always works against Satan, always does. Turns everything around to everyone else's good. Incredible. Let's go to chapter 4 here. This is the last one we'll look at today. Again, God is giving us a great focus, an ability to just be able to think about, to meditate, to look upon the fact that this being has been here for 6,000 years. He's caused every kind of sorrow, hurt, and pain and suffering. He wants us to have this deeply embedded in our minds at the beginning of the feast here about that being and what he's done. How much he has hurt human beings. How much suffering he's continued to cause through time. So we can rejoice more at God's plan and purpose that he's working out. Matthew 4 and verse 1. Then Jesus stood up in the Spirit in the wilderness. God's Spirit, in other words, led him out into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. So that was a purpose. You know, God was working through Jesus Christ here to fulfill certain things, to accomplish certain things, and in any way he was to go out there, again, something written, it's all written for us, and something that Jesus Christ experienced in the very beginning of his ministry, or before his ministry even began, actually. And when, or the word is after, he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. And when the tempter came to him, he said, if you are the Son of God. So he tried to deal with him as with any human being. And no one else could do this except Christ. And this being, that's why I mentioned so often, greater is he that's in the world. Greater is he that's in you, I'm sorry, than he that's in the world. So again, back in 1 John, when we quote that so often, that's our strength, God that's in us, than he that's in the world, speaking of Satan and the demons, because of the powers that they have. And so there are things here that Satan didn't understand about Jesus Christ and about the fact that he was the Son of God. He didn't get it. He didn't understand what that meant. He just saw another weak, miserable human being to him. That's what he was. He didn't grasp who he is dealing with. And so God has recorded these things for our strength, for our benefit, for our being able to be in awe as we learn and grow about our Passover and about our soon coming King, Jesus Christ. And so after he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry, and the tempter came and said, if you are the Son of God, because for human beings, you know what? Sometimes you're challenged about certain things and you're lifted up with pride because you're going to respond to certain other people if they challenge you about certain things. And it's akin to sometimes people challenging you about your religious beliefs. If you're really the Church of God, if you really, then why did this happen? You know, and then we panic because we have to defend self. No, you don't. No, you don't. You don't have to defend yourself. And sometimes we're not very smart if we try to. They can't understand what you tell them anyway. What good's it going to do? If you tell them a whole truth and are able to go through the whole plan with them, do you think they're going to appreciate what you have to say? Do you think they're going to grasp what you have to say? Not at all. They're still going to think you're nuts. You know, that you've, I'm going to say, flown over the cuckoo's nest. Anyway, you're out of it. That's what they think. And this isn't going to persuade anyone. But what the dangerous thing is that you take it personally. And you bristle up with pride and selfishness or self to protect self. You don't have to protect self. This is about God. This is about God's plan. You're a part of God's calling. You don't have to defend that. You're in God's hands. You don't have to justify anything to anybody. It is what it is. The truth is the truth, and one day they'll understand it. So if you be the Son of God, cast yourself down, for it's written, He shall give His angels charge concerning you, and by their hands they shall carry you up, lest at any time you dash your foot against a stone. So he tried to tempt him against his using pride, you know. That's how he works. I jumped down, didn't I? I'm sorry. Same thing happened again and again here. It says, if you be the Son of God, command these stones be made bread. So he was hungry. It says, so he sought to, and here again, it's a matter of trying to tempt him through lust of the flesh and pride and so forth here. That's how we function as human beings. And we're so easily tempted in these areas. Jesus Christ wasn't. But he answered and said, backing up to verse 4, and I'll finish that part first. Is it not written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God? Then the devil took him up into the holy city and sent him up on a pinnacle of the temple. Now, we can't understand what all this is about, what it all means, but again here, these things that were being shown, these things were being that Satan was doing and so forth here, but again, he did appeal to Christ when he was hungry. He was hungry. There's no doubt about it. I can't understand that. 40 days being sustained by God. He was sustained by God. You can't do this physically and live. God sustained him. But that doesn't take away the fact that he brings you right to the point as a human being. You're hungry. You want water. What's it like to go for a day without water and food? You know, mentally, as soon as you start it, I do. I'm pretty much ready to drink a drink. I mean, I'm thirsty, even though I just had a glass of water. But I know it's sundown. It's atonement. You can't have a glass of water. And when you're told you can't have a glass of water, it does something to the mind. It does my mind. You know? And so it's set. And so here, after all this period of time, that long a time, yes, you're hungry, you're thirsty, and God lets us experience that to a physical degree, to a point in this particular case here to be sustained and so forth. But anyway, so he tried to tempt him in these areas, Satan did, and he wasn't tempted. He came back with answers that were a matter of something from God. So important to remember when you answer people. You don't have to give them a long explanation. Something to the point. Something that's accurate and true that they're not going to grasp and comprehend anyway. But that's it. No self-justification. No trying to... So often, what do we try to do? We try to protect self. You know, we it's this defensive thing. You're the true church of God? If you're the true church of God, then why did this happen? Why didn't that happen? And it's almost like we bristle up and we've got to defend ourselves. No, you don't. You're living by faith. How can you give that to anyone? God has blessed us to grow stronger in faith as we've gone through some of these things. He has blessed you with greater strength spiritually. If you understand faith and what He's doing in you and the confidence you have, the boldness you have of, if it be keeping another Feast of Tabernacles, to have the confidence and boldness that you know that whatever time remains after that period of time is plenty of time to fulfill everything that God says is going to happen on this earth. And the shorter that is, what a blessing still to be able to be accomplished. How long can you go? You might be tested in that. Anyway, going on here. And it's not about you're defending yourself against someone else. It's your faith. It's your confidence. It's your relationship between you and God. You can't give that to anyone else. You don't have to defend that either. And so going on here, and I've already read the other part here about being cast down and so forth, and the things that Satan said, and Jesus Christ came back in verse 7 and says, "You shall not tempt the Lord your God." And so again it says, "The devil took him up to an exceeding high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them." Because Satan has power. God has given him power to govern, to rule on this earth. To a degree, to a point, there are certain things he can't do and certain things that God is going to accomplish and fulfill. But as a whole, he is the God of this world. We understand that. Verse 9, "And said to him, all these things will I give you, if you will fall down and worship me." Now, it's almost astounding to because of what we know and where we are, to think that he could have believed that the Son of God, that Jesus Christ, would kneel down and worship him. But he believed this. That's why he did this. And for a human being, whatever was placed before him, for an average, normal human being, he would have succumbed to this. And this is something that's hard for us to grasp and comprehend. We wouldn't have the ability as human beings to resist because of our pride and because of our selfishness. We think in terms of, because God's opened our mind and we see things spiritually, we think, how could that be? But see, you see things that and comprehend things that a person out here in the world can't. And so you have to be careful how you judge those things. And so these things aren't just written here that there was nothing there. And for the average human being in the world, or any human being, any other human being candidly in the world, that this wouldn't be a problem for, long before he ever got to this point here, that we could read through something like this and say, well, that wasn't that great a thing. Yes, it was. Yes, it was. This was a war. This is a war of wars that was waged here. And Jesus Christ stood firm as the Son of God against a being who was waging war against God, who sought to destroy God's plan and purpose. If he could persuade God's own Son, which he didn't grasp and understand what that meant, everything is his. He destroys all of God's plan, all of God's purpose for all human beings. He knew enough by that point in time to know that everything that God is doing is in this. It's in what's taking place here. Incredible. We read things in a little story like this and we so often just don't get it. We don't get the magnitude of it, of what took place. We don't see what was waged here. We don't see the importance of what was waged here. This was awesomely important of what took place. It just covered in a few verses. But we read through it as a nice little story if we're not careful. And we don't grasp here what took place for us, for each one of us. Then Jesus said to him, "Get away from here, Satan, for it's written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." Then the devil left him, and behold, the angels came and ministered to him. Incredible. Incredible story. Got time to read one more here. Luke 22. Again, just this being who is constantly there trying to destroy God's plan and purpose. And it's hard to understand such a perverted mind. It's just, to us it's mind-boggling because we have God's Spirit. So this is again around Passover. When we looked at some of these different examples around Passover this past year of the people who were turning against Christ around the Passover season, that final Passover season, who were moved with greater hatred toward Jesus Christ, they were moved by greater hatred by Satan. He was the one behind this. He was the one behind stirring up the hatred. He was the one stirring up the priests. He was the one that was there stirring up the rulers. He was the one who was behind everything that was going astray, that was going wrong, that was going bad against Jesus Christ. Satan was the one behind those things. He truly was. He agitated and he stirred up those things by a spirit presence. That's, again, a very powerful thing that's sometimes difficult for us to grasp and comprehend. So, again, just as Jesus also revealed who it was that was to destroy him by the greed and pride-filled choices that he made in Judas Iscariot that we went through and discussed here when he said the things he did about Judas. Luke 22 and verse 1. That being who is always there, trying to get at, trying to work his way in, trying to weed his way in to destroy. He's done it in the church of God over and over and over. I am dumbfounded. But Luke 22, verse 1. "Now the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called Passover. And the chief priests and scribes sought, in other words, they tried to figure out a way, how they might kill him, for they feared the people. Then entered Satan into Judas, surnamed Iscariot, being of the number of the 12. And he went his way and communed with the chief priests and the captains how he might betray him unto them. Didn't have full control of him in the sense that he didn't know what he was doing. Judas knew. But he was moved very powerfully so that his great influence came from Satan the entire period of time, who indeed was in his mind. And Judas accepted it and received it and played upon those things. And because of his weakness when it came to the treasury and the use of money and so forth, and his attitude toward Christ that continued to change, and he sought even more finance out of this, how he might betray him, because he's either going to kill him anyway, they're going to put him all in prison. Whatever was going through his mind, we don't know, but he went to betray him. Verse 5, it says, and they were glad and agreed. I'm getting tongue-tied with that one. To give him money. So they made an agreement with him, a pact with him to give him money. And he promised and sought opportunity to betray him unto them in the absence of the multitude. So, in other words, when there was a time when there was not a large multitude around, and obviously it came at night and some things had happened. But again, look who's always there. Satan. The adversary. The one who's fought against God for so long. For so long, there has not been peace in the universe. There's not been peace within the angelic realm for a long, long time. That's what's so important about the sermons we went through before the feast, and I'm seeing that in a greater way as we go along here. What an awesome thing as God leads and guides and directs us and builds us up, builds up to a time of the Feast of Tabernacles and the things He's going to give to us at this feast. But the subject matter, it's awesome. It truly is. To understand the importance of God's desire for peace, to have a city that reflects the way of peace, something that God wants to give to mankind, a rest that God desires to see the angelic realm experience and the kingdom of God experience that hasn't been there for so, so long because of this being and those whom He led with Him. So tomorrow we'll continue on with part two of this series and conclude this having to do with Satan. And we'll sing another song. And hopefully be able to do a little bit better here at the particular song here when we lead everyone. Hopefully that went well with everyone in all the areas. And with that, we'd all rise. I'd like to ask Mr. Adrian Gray to come forward for the closing prayer.
Almighty God, we do thank You that we've been able to gather here before You this day. We thank You for the teaching You're giving us, the understanding that You're giving to us more and more. We do ask that You continue to give us understanding, that You give us the ability to retain this, to put it to use in our lives. And now as we have our lunch break, we thank You for providing the food, the further fellowship we'll be able to have. And we do thank You for all this in and through the name of Your Son, our Saviour, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.